Okay, welcome everybody, and on behalf of the AU Arts and Science Research Talk Series, we want to thank you for attending today's presentation at ELC, and for those of you attending via the Illuminate Live. We have some upcoming presentations. One is on Friday, November 10th, and that is Dr. Robert Holmberg, who is presenting the arachnids of Alberta, spiders, scorpions, and other things nice. FOIP announcement. According to FOIP regulations, we must inform you that today's session is being recorded. And this is the purpose of recording, is to allow people who are unable to attend the session today to view the proceedings at a later time. The recording of the session will be made available on the research website at a later date. So it is now my pleasure to introduce Bob Feller, who will introduce today's speaker. Bob?
Hi, can you hear me? It's Kathy, not Bob. Welcome everyone. We are very excited about the Arts and Sciences Research Talk Series this year, and we'd like to thank Leslie for initiating the series last year. It's a great opportunity for us to get to know our colleagues and to learn about what other people in the university are doing. So please tell your friends and have them join us either on Illuminate or in person at ELC. I'd like to introduce Ella Haley, who will be giving our first talk, a very timely topic, I think, Alberta Disadvantage. And Ella is, of course, coordinator of Environmental Studies 305. She's an assistant professor of sociology. Her research interests are the environment and health, environmental sociology, popular epidemiology, environmental health inquiries, community organizing, and institutional ethnography. And Ella is joining us all the way from Ontario. She's on research day this year, so we'd like to thank her for taking the time out to come and talk to us today. Go ahead, Ella.
Thank you. I can't hear if you ring a bell, so I'll watch to see if you wave a sign at me there for time or whatever. I thought I'd just give you a bit of background. I did my PhD thesis on a contaminated community out in southeastern Ontario. It was a phosphate processing factory. And then when I moved out west to work for Athabasca University, one of the largest phosphate processing factories was located in the Alberta Industrial Heartland. And that's how I became involved. Citizens were getting ready for a hearing 2 years ago, and I helped them to find the experts. And they did a form of popular epidemiology that I'll talk about today. So as I worked with these people who were getting ready to present their information in a hearing about the expansion of the phosphate factory, I looked around at the area and basically became involved reading documents. I do a lot of textual analysis, looking at what other industries were there and what these people were being exposed to. Next slide. So here's just a bit of an overview of what I'll talk about. This is a huge area. I'll explain later how big it is. The pollution problems that the people are facing. And I come first from a Bachelor of Science, biological science background. So I'm very interested, even though I'm a sociologist, in the cumulative, as your exposures add up over your lifetime, and the synergistic effects. That's the combined effect of being exposed to different pollutants. 1 + 1 is not 2 when it comes to exposure. There's a synergistic effect that is much larger. I'll also be looking at disciplining dissent, how people are silenced or muzzled. They don't speak up even if they have concerns, and I'll explain some of the what happens there to cause people to even silence themselves. And then I come and look at when we knowingly expose a population to environmental contaminants, when we know that they're carcinogens, when we know that they cause health problems, then I've written in my own writing, I've written about organizational deceit and organizational crime. This involves governments and industry basically knowing about exposures and not protecting the public health. And then I'll move on and look at community organizing and how citizens are trying to build coalitions with NGOs, with church groups between different communities. And finally, I'll look at Sarnia. It's way ahead of the industrial heartland. It's had the petrochemical industry there for many more years, and they now have a cancer epidemic. Next slide. Okay, this is on the website for the Alberta Industrial Heartland, and I just wanted to read it. The Alberta Advantage is more than just the inherent entrepreneurial spirit and abundance of natural resource. It's a balanced budget, no sales tax, low personal and corporate income tax in Alberta, competitive property tax, construction expertise, a skilled workforce, and a progressive labor market. There's another quote on this website that refers to a minimum of red tape. Next slide, please. So I just wanted to explain to you, this area is just northeast of Edmonton. It's 330 square kilometers in four different municipalities. Strathcona County, which includes Fort Saskatchewan, Sturgeon County, just south of Redwater, Lamont County, and I've mentioned the city of Fort Saskatchewan. It's just very recent that this area was rezoned in 2001. Really, that's really when the whole Alberta Industrial Heartland was formed to basically woo chemical, petrochemical, and petroleum industries because of the tar sand boom, but also the Redwater gas field is underneath this area. And so that's partly why industry, there's a history of industry being here along the North Saskatchewan River and near these gas fields. Next slide, please. So I just wanted to show you how this area is connected to the tar sands, to the Mackenzie Valley pipeline if it ever comes in, and to the markets in the U.S. and the rest of Canada. So I'm hoping that you can see that website. Okay. So I'll just start with the Alaska Gas and the Mackenzie Delta Gas. There's a big push by the folks in Fort McMurray, the industries there, to push the Mackenzie Delta the Mackenzie pipeline through. They're hoping to use the gas to help them to with the tar sands operations in Fort McMurray and in that area. But the bitumen has been sent by pipeline down to northeast of Edmonton. The heart there is the Alberta Industrial Heartland. And then you'll see we're also now tapping into coal and methane. So you'll see the whole energy market here and how then the pipelines and trains lead to the states, to American markets. Next slide, please. Or next, my next slide. So, that we've just looked at that. Okay, so we can go to the next slide. I'll wait for you to, can you move to that next slide? Okay, now I don't know if we can get this website. It basically shows a lot of the chemicals that are being shipped by pipeline, and if you can't access it right now, it's a very, it really shows all the chemicals. There's huge number of them. What I've worked with looking at reports is when there's been train derailments, you can see it also lists the chemicals that are shipped by train. And there's been some recent accidents. For example, some of the chemicals being shipped, very, very dangerous, ammonia, and sulfuric acid. So I'll just let you look at that website at your own leisure, but that sort of shows you a lot of the chemicals that are being used. This website talks about being eco-industrial venture that they do because they're so close, the different industries, that they can ship chemicals back and forth. But part of my textual analysis in my other writing involves challenging this green talk. Okay, next slide. Here's one more website that we won't look at. Again, you can access at your leisure. The main website that you can access is the Alberta Industrial Heartland website. It's www.industrialheartland.com. And from there, if you move around on that site, you'll be able to look up existing businesses and basically just let you see, read about them. And they're the petroleum, chemical, petrochemical, some agriculture products being produced, for example, the phosphate fertilizer, and then other industries there as well. Next slide. So I basically have watched the various documents that have prevented citizens from speaking up with their concerns. I've gone to hearings, I've gone to public meetings, and read newspaper articles, read letters to the editor, read letters that haven't been published as well. So basically, citizens are trying to go to their council meetings in the different municipalities. They'll have their name on the agenda, they'll be scheduled to speak, and they'll show up. And for example, they showed up just last March already to basically express their concerns about the further expansion of the industrial heartland. It used to be 300 square kilometers, and now it's 330. And they had their name on the agenda, and then council explained that their lawyer had advised them they could not hear the citizens' presentations, and that they were going in camera. And so a vote was then made after they went in camera, and the citizens left very disappointed, some in tears. That was in Strathcona County. There's also secret deals going on, industry and different municipalities. In this case, Strathcona, citizens were talking about Strathcona sending out a landman, but industry also sends out a landman who makes deals with residents, farmers, rural people, landowners. Basically, an industry is thinking of coming to the area. They're hoping to buy land that's not necessarily in the area that's been zoned industrial. And so basically a promise is made to purchase land from different landowners. It may be up to, say, 21 different landowners if it's a big corporation needing lots of land. And these people basically are tied to a secrecy clause, a gag clause. They can't tell their neighbors. And it divides the community because people start guessing. You know, they know this industry's coming. And so it may be that your next-door neighbor sold his farm and you've been longtime friends and neighbors, and now you're going to have to live next to this factory, and you don't even know what's coming. Different people, the third thing there, not directly affected. People are deemed not directly affected, and they may have concerns if they're outside a 5-kilometer area, if they're 5 kilometers away from a big, huge bitumen upgrader, a big, huge oil refinery, then they cannot get assistance in finding experts to help them go to a hearing. And 5 kilometers is not that far when you're talking about air pollution and water pollution. So these people are deemed not directly affected. I just recently sent a letter in about an upgrader that's planned coming, and I was sent a polite letter saying, you're not deemed directly affected because of your Edmonton address. It's too far away, and therefore your concerns will not be officially recorded, and you will not even be sent official notice of the outcome. Different residents try to write letters to the editor. They know about train derailments. They know about chemical spills. They know about tanks, you know, a lid blowing on a tank. Last March when I was there, a tank had just blown its lid. And stories just don't get published, or else there's the industry version of what happened. So it's another form of people feeling that they've been silenced. There was one community organizer who's since been relocated, but a group of citizens had concerns about a bitumen upgrader that was coming in Strathcona County. And one of the community organizers was repeatedly approached by a key industry official, and the terminology was, if your group does not remove the request for hearing, then the gloves come off. And that was made repeatedly. So it's quite intimidating for citizens. You know, they have these concerns. They know about chemical spills, train derailments. and then to have these threats. The third thing is you may have people who are speaking up, who are quite vocal, and yet a lot of people there, it's a double whammy. They work in industry, but they also live next to it. And that's the population that is the most exposed, people who get occupational exposure and then who live next to a facility that's emitting toxins. So you may have somebody who's quite vocal, but then the relative is approached at work and their job is threatened. It may be just subtle innuendo, but again, this happened to people just recently. Next slide. The other problem is you have what we call the Fort Air Partnership, and very strongly influenced by industry, basically initiated originally, industry now working with Capital Health. But you'll see later we look at a critique of the science that they do, how they monitor, and basically it's pretty shoddy science. In hearings, or even before hearings, when an industry is setting up, they will present to the government, it's a public document, it will go to, say, the Environmental Utility Board or sometimes the NRCB, Natural Resources, NRCB, just forgetting the rest of that acronym, Conservation. But they'll present their environmental impact assessment, they'll present some scientific studies that they have funded. And if people do not win the right to hearing, then basically they lose the right to challenge that industry-funded scientific report. And so we'll look later at some of the problems with monitoring the emissions there. Next slide. There's also a problem in the Alberta Industrial Heartland. People running into and challenging this and writing about this, community leaders arguing that they don't really have regulatory protection. A lot of toxins that are emitted do not have pollution standards. There's guidelines, and these guidelines are not enforceable. So they're quite concerned that there's very little regulation and just these basically very lenient guidelines. Next slide. So the residents have started organizing. When the Alberta Industrial Heartland first was formed, people found out about it really at a very late point in the story. And so they formed the Heartland Citizens Coalition in different areas, in Sturgeon, Strathcona, Lamont. The Strathcona citizens challenged the restructuring of their county. They challenged that so much land was now being zoned industrial. It's very good farmland. It's very close to Edmonton. And as we think more and more about the Eat Local food movement, this is one of the potato capitals, a key area for growing potatoes for Alberta. And so now this area is being zoned industrial, a lot of it being zoned heavy industrial. So they challenged it and lost it. They had to pay their own lawyer fees, plus they had to pay $3,500 for county costs, just for faxing, various costs. They did not have to pay the legal fees. Next slide. And more recently, we have the expansion. The bitumen is now being shipped down by pipeline. There's this quest for the U.S. really is hungry for safe oil that's not dependent upon the Middle East. And so the bitumen upgraders are now sending their oil down to this area. And upgraders are, they're great big huge factories that process the oil and refine it. So you have the Northwest upgrader trying to get regulatory approval. The Senanco upgrader, it will soon be seeking approval. The BA upgrader in Strathcona County, the Petro-Can upgrader. And then there's people know that there's huge industries coming, but there's still a lot of secrecy. The landman might be out buying your neighbor's farm. They know that there's a big developer coming, but it hasn't been announced. A biodiesel plant coming in, and then a pipe facility. Next slide. So some of the environmental concerns these people have, the North Saskatchewan River basically is a major, major river for the prairies. David Schindler spoke at the hearing that I attended 2 years ago for the phosphate factory, and he said this plant should never have been built upon such a major river that's so important for people downstream. There's a risk of groundwater contamination, and I've got the map right here of Strathcona County, and it's very vulnerable to groundwater contamination, and here we are building huge, heavy industrial factories on top of a very vulnerable area. And then people have the air pollution. They seem to notice that more than the water, but the water is just as important. So people live with air pollution every day. In the winter, it's especially difficult sometimes with weather inversion, and people have their animals, perfectly healthy animals, will drop dead during heavy inversion. People are worried about the impact on their health, on their livestock, their pets, their gardens and their farms. With the Agrium hearing, the phosphate factory, the citizens brought in fluoride experts who advised them that their garden produce was way over the limit as far as fluoride contamination, and that they should not eat from their gardens, they should not pick the wild berries. Local dairy cattle and beef cattle showed signs of fluoride contamination. Noise, people find that pretty unbearable. They have to sleep in their basements. People who live near the Agrium factory gave testimony to this 2 years ago in the hearing. Chemical odors, chemical flares, and sometimes these flares come conveniently on a Friday evening, on a weekend, when there's no Alberta Environment Authorities at work. Chemical accidents, there's been a number of them lately, train derailments. And then people worry about the emergency response and evacuation concerns. Next slide. So David Swan has been working closely with this community and come out and given talks. He's the environment critic for Alberta, the Alberta Liberal Caucus. And he's arguing that health assessments, even in these hearings, health assessments do not look at the cumulative effects, people being exposed to contaminants over a period of time. Science just can't do that very well, and so we're working with a great deal of exposure, but a lot of scientific uncertainty and not enough research. I've talked about the synergistic and cumulative impacts to these many chemicals. Next slide. It just more recently, people were raising issues. They were working outside, and there was a recent spill at Shell just September, the week of September 5th. And there is supposed to be monitoring by the Fort Air Partnership. And so people turned to that website to find out they saw a cloud of black smoke, and there was no air monitoring reports. The system was down for a period, and there were no reports. When people suspect that there's been a spill, they're supposed to call a hotline and find out what's going on, or industry is supposed to call them. Some people get left out, though, and in March, some people who were working outside, farmers, people were outside, and they were not notified. So there's a lot of flaws with notifying people. Next slide. I just mentioned the onus is on residents to call this hotline. There's also shelter-in-place routine where you're supposed to, when you're notified that it's shelter-in-place or when you contact this hotline and it says shelter-in-place, it means that there's been a very serious chemical spill. You should go home, and there's a whole routine. You should tape up your windows. People have been taught, they're given videos on how to basically hide away in the house and keep it safe so that chemicals don't enter the house. But there's people who are outside, there's pipeline workers, there's livestock, pets, farmers. Next slide. So basically, the residents have been going to the legislature, they've been going to their politicians, local and provincial, and this is basically what they've been presenting. This is a summary of what they present when they go to council meetings. They basically feel that they do not have a fair public consultation process and they want it. They're critical of what happens right now because it seems to be that industry sort of co-sponsors these consultation processes, or the EUB, the Environmental Utilities Board, receives funding from industry and then sits and adjudicates applications. So that's what they mean by legitimate. They challenged the directly affected clause, and they want that removed because pollution has no boundaries. It travels further than 5 kilometers, and they feel that this really is undemocratic. They want an independent, not industry-funded, they want an independent cumulative environmental impact assessment of current and proposed industrial activity before any more industrial activity is brought into this area. They're sort of saying enough is enough. And then they want to stop the rezoning of land for industrial use until we go back and take a broader view. The Alberta government is being asked to basically bring in a land use strategy. It's promised it, but it hasn't appeared. So that's basically what the residents are asking for. Next slide. My area of research is popular epidemiology. I've looked at it with a historic case in Ontario and with the Agrium hearing that happened 2 years ago, the phosphate factory. Citizens worked with experts and often at a distance to challenge government reports and to challenge industry-funded research. Next slide. So more recently, this is a hearing that did not take place. BA Energy wanted to set up they're bringing in an upgrader to process the bitumen. Donald Blake was hired by the citizens. The citizens received intervener funding, and so they worked closely with him. He came and took over 80 air samples. The citizens worked with him, showing him where the air pollution was especially bad, showing him, you know, where to sample because of the wind direction, the predominant wind directions. And then Donald Blake critiqued the air sampling that BA Energy had worked with when they presented their environmental report. Next slide. So this is some of Blake's critique of shoddy air monitoring. He's calling for additional air sampling using analytical techniques that are proven to be reliable. So he's questioning the reliability of the analytical techniques that were used by industry and by Alberta Environment. And he's just saying we need this if we're going to adequately and accurately assess the exposures that people have to environmental contaminants. Because the air in the study area is remarkably polluted, Blake said it was as bad as some cities in China, as bad as New York City, then it's especially important to do this before we build any more industrial facilities. Next slide. The citizens are also working with NGOs, and Environmental Defense has come in, and they've been doing a sample. If you go to the Environmental Defense website, they basically have gone across Canada and done a sample of how many chemicals are in some people. They've sort of done, they picked people who are in a contaminated area, for example, this woman who lives in the Alberta Industrial Heartland, but they've also picked famous people, Robert Bateman, offered to do it. Some people with famous names, I'm forgetting them right now, but they've offered to be tested as samples. So in this case, Cheryl Henkelman, a community leader for the Alberta Industrial Heartland citizens groups, agreed to be tested. She's a non-smoker, vegetarian, eats 20% organic, and she had 41 of 88 chemicals that they were testing. 35 of them with reproductive and developmental potential for developmental disorders. Next slide. Blake's critique was that the Fort Air partnership, which involves industry, often self-monitoring as well, but also air monitoring stations in the community, he argues that these were not located where there were high concentrations of contaminants or toxins being emitted. Many chemicals are not being monitored by the Fort Air Partnership, and it's just a very limited type of air monitoring program. Next slide. So citizens are becoming more and more organized because really they were quite strong in the Agrium hearing. I think industry did not know couldn't believe how organized the citizens were in that inquiry. Different industries came and sat in on the AVRM inquiry because different industries knew that their number was coming up. They would be heading into potentially they might have an environmental inquiry about the renewal of their permit, or they were seeking to build an industrial facility. So as of 2006, we now have the Citizens for Responsible Development of Alberta's Industrial Heartland Region. And they're working closely with the Council of Canadians. They also work closely with opposition parties, the Liberal Environment Critic in particular, and the New Democratic Party. And they're working with other groups across Alberta who are affected by gas and oil development. Next slide. So I just wanted to stress the importance of lay knowledge. This sort of builds upon popular epidemiology. And I just wanted to borrow from Brown. He is quite a famous environmental health researcher with contaminated communities. He's worked with information related to Love Canal, and some of you have seen the film A Civil Action that also works with the Woburn community. He's worked quite closely with Woburn. So he's arguing that we emphasize the importance of lay disease discovery and knowledge production, and how different interests shape medical knowledge and social policy, and how as a result of these conflicts, science and government often fail to provide adequately for the public health. So I just wanted to go back to the lay disease discovery. We really rely upon hunters. They often, out in Newfoundland, they were the first to spot the diseased rabbits and diseased moose, again, who were downwind from a phosphate processing factory. Phosphate processing factories seem to be, they're my specialty, so that's why I know about these across Canada. Lay disease discovery in Love Canal. It was stay-at-home moms watching their kids who came home from playing on the school ground. The school ground was built on land that was sold to the school board for $1, and it was underneath were all of these toxic barrels of chemicals, and they were oozing up. And when children ran on the playground barefoot, they would get itchy feet. It's people in Love Canal looking at their basements and watching the chemicals that oozed into their basements. And so it's important to build upon this lay knowledge. Often stay-at-home mothers, as in Love Canal, farmers, as in Fort Saskatchewan, they notice their cows that are limping or sick, and the hunters and fishermen, people fishing alongside the North Saskatchewan River, notice fish with tumors. So that's just really crucial that we build upon the knowledge. Next slide. And I just wanted to build upon Thornton, another great writer as far as environmental crime, environmental history. And so he's talking about reflexive science. It means that people understand that scientific knowledge is a cultural product. It reflects not only the reality of nature, but also the social conditions of its production and the political purposes for which it will be used. David Schindler spoke about industry-paid consultants, and was critical of how it can put blinders on industry-funded scientists. We know the saying, he who pays the piper calls the tune, or she who pays the piper calls the tune. And so scientific consultants know where their bread is buttered. They know that they will not have their contract renewed if they put a company in a bad light. We've seen the famous Nancy Oliveri case. It sort of crosses over with academic freedom. She had a huge grant. She was concerned about it, went to the funding body that was funding her research and said, we have to tell the parents that this drug that we're testing has negative side effects. And she was fired for it. So there's a whole issue of academic freedom there. Next slide. Okay, I hope I don't give you too much jargon here, but when I work with popular epidemiology or barefoot epidemiology, grassroots epidemiology, they step back and critique mainstream, the biomedical model, and it's what we call the dominant epidemiological paradigm. It's very influenced by the biomedical model. And so when we look at mainstream epidemiology, often these studies have been used to rule out environmental health concerns in contaminated communities. they often don't make the link between a contaminant and maybe a doctor-caused treatment or medical-caused treatment that's iatrogenic, or another problem, for example, pollution, that results in poor treatment and poor prevention. I'll give you an example. Epidemiology often relies upon a certain size of sample group. Whereas if you live in a small contaminated community, you may see that people are, there's a cluster of people who say have fluorosis, the children are showing fluorosis, as they did in Strathcona County. We found that before the AGRIM hearing, and this information was presented during the hearing. And so this was poo-pooed during the hearing. They were saying, well, it's not enough children, and you have exposures, you know, to fluoride in drinking water and toothpaste. But this community does not drink tap water. They don't drink fluoridated water. So that's just one example of how you have people challenging the mainstream epidemiological paradigm. Next slide. So popular epidemiology basically involves people, lay people working with scientists, often very revered scientists who are recognized as experts in their field, and they conduct epidemiological studies, or they help them gather data, or because of their local knowledge, they help these scientists to go and gather samples in areas that where scientists may not have looked. So you have oppositional, these critical scholars are often called oppositional professionals. They bring with them critical epidemiology. They've been challenging mainstream epidemiology, and they work with lay people in what we call popular epidemiology. Next slide. So there's some steps to this. I'll just sort of go through some of them. Basically, people begin not wanting to challenge, not even making the connection, but they start to see pollutants. They see damage to their crops. They see their animals limping into the milking parlor. And I've done that. I've helped people out in the community. I've helped to milk cows. I come from a dairy farm, and I've seen these animals hardly able to come into the milking parlor because of fluoride poisoning. And they start to look at health effects in themselves and their communities as well. And so back in southeastern Ontario, the CBC worked with people. That's probably one of the first cases of popular epidemiology in Canada. And they worked with people. They brought in a fluoride expert from Detroit, Michigan, and they had him examine their cow, he was a human health expert. He basically worked with them, couldn't examine them because he was a U.S. doctor, but recognized enough symptoms, and then had them come to Detroit, and he even there safely in a U.S. clinic where he could legally practice medicine and help them to make the connection. So people start, number two, they start to suspect this connection between the health of their animals, their pets, the pollutants. Next slide. And then they start to share these observations. You know, they compare notes with a neighbor, and then they start to come together and raise concerns. Love Canal, you've got Lois Gibbs. She's a stay-at-home mom, and she starts to just compare notes with her neighbors. Did they have this gooey stuff coming into their basement? Are their kids, you know, do their kids have itchy, burning feet after they play on the playground? And they start to come together and then go door to door. And then they start to try to ask questions. Often they get stonewalled. Often they get dismissed. But they start to ask questions from government officials, from industry, from even local reporters. Next slide. And so I'm ahead of myself. They talk to government and industry officials. They talk to local scientific experts about their suspicion. And then they start to organize groups. They start to try to get their story in the paper, letters to the editor. Maybe some reporter, sympathetic reporter, helps them break the story. Next slide. And then they start to pressure the government agencies. They want investigation. They suspect that there's a problem. Nobody's been looking into it. Could you look into it? Could we have a hearing? Whatever. They find experts who will work with them. And they start to try to trace the pathways. If we look at Woburn, basically mothers were sitting in a clinic, and as they made connections in the clinic, they saw that these parents over here lived on that part of town, and these parents with more leukemia lived in this part, and they started to trace the water distribution patterns. There were different pipelines throughout the community in Woburn, and then gradually they traced newspaper stories, and they followed the water upstream, and they found that there had been contaminated barrels upstream, and I believe it was vinyl chloride in that case had gotten into the water, polyvinyl chloride. Okay, and then they start to, if they've worked with oppositional scientists, some scientists will work for free with them because they may be experts in the area and they believe the citizens and they know how to help them document it. So then they try to show these results to government and industry officials. Next slide. And then they try to seek action. They, if they've been able to, you know, basically show some scientific reports, show a link to their health problems, then they try to say, hey, will you move us out of here? And that's what the people who are closest to the industry in the Alberta Industrial Heartland are doing. They're trying to get moved out of the area. They don't want to live next to industry. Or they want compensation for the loss of a loved one, the loss of their livestock. Some people are pursuing toxic tort. There's one woman who would still like to pursue. Her sheep died. They documented that it was from fluoride pollution. There's only one key source of fluoride contamination in the area. That's Agrium, and so it was easy to make the link. So she's considering going after, following up with a toxic tort lawsuit. Or they want cleanup of the contaminants. They want stricter pollution controls, not just guidelines. They want enforceable regulations and stringent pollution controls to protect public health. They try to participate in environmental hearings. That takes a lot of time. They lobby politicians, and some of them, you know, basically do protest, direct action, where they dress up and show up in the legislature dressed up or whatever, but trying to get media attention, trying to get these pollution problems investigated. Next slide. Okay, poppy epidemiology is solid science. The scientists work with citizens to control for bias, but we also have to recognize that no scientist or citizen is completely value neutral. We bring values to our research. Sylvia Tesh has written about that, and I have an interview with her that's it's on the Aurora website. So it documents, you'll have Tesh documenting that no scientist is absolutely neutral. They bring values to their work. And these values lead scientists basically to choose the areas of work that they want to follow, to choose the research questions that they are interested in. Popular epidemiology is also a social movement. It's a form of protest against state and industry-funded research. Next slide. So I just wanted to close off with just a summary here. I have a few more notes besides this slide. Citizen groups are challenging the legitimacy of official counts, and they're learning how to do science by working with oppositional scientists doing collaborative research. Perhaps the most famous case right now is if you go to the Silent Spring Institute, named after, in memory of Rachel Carson. She herself died of breast cancer, but when she was when she brought her book out, Silent Spring, she was very, very discreet. She did not tell people that she had breast cancer. And so the Silent Spring Institute works with breast cancer survivors. It teaches them science. It teaches them how to learn enough science so that they can sit at the table with experts and they can raise questions about how research is done, about research reports. So that's one of the very best cases, and you can just Google Silent Spring Institute. Citizen groups are organizing to find answers to questions that stump experts and that are basically, they're going after industry and government, and they're holding them responsible for their exposures and for their environmental health problems. So I just wanted to speak a little bit further. If we look at Sarnia, we'll see that we do have a cancer epidemic. I've worked a lot with environmental health problems, and when industry knowingly and repeatedly has exposures, has leaks of environmental contaminants that are known to be carcinogens, that are human health toxins, then I call that environmental crime. And often we have repeat offenders. Industry is a repeated offender because there's very little enforcement. If there is enforcement, the fines are very low compared to the profit that the industry is making by getting away with it. So industries often opt to just pay a fine if they are caught. And often they're not caught if they do the releases, as is common on Friday evenings after or weekends when there's nobody to enforce it. So I wanted us to keep our eye on Sarnia, because basically Sarnia is the example. This is where we're headed. If we're looking at this community, we're headed for a lot of environmental health problems in the residents. And I'll sign off for now.
Thanks very much. Oh, that was really interesting, and I think it makes us really reflect on what's going on around us. And what entered my mind right at the end of your talk was, how responsible are we ourselves for this because of the lifestyle that we have become accustomed to and that we demand in many ways? Does anybody have any questions for Ella or comments about the talk?
Hi, Ella. It's Vicki Bush here.
Am I on?
Two questions, I guess. One is, have you come across any studies or any examples of anybody finding any connections between Crohn's disease or other autoimmune diseases and the areas where there are gas wells? And the second question would be, can you recommend any action? I know you did have a slide that recommended things that people can do, but sort of advocate, what can we do in Alberta to make changes to that sort of 5-kilometer limit on who is heard on some of these issues?
Sorry, just a moment. My phone just rang. I don't know if it's you calling me. Hello? Oh, just a moment. I'm in a conference, okay? Sorry about that. Vicki, I just wanted to speak to your first question. I used to be a therapist in the hospital, worked a lot with multiple sclerosis, so I sort of have my ear to the ground on that. And when I first moved to Athabasca, the lady in the health food store talked about MS, the high MS rates, which is multiple sclerosis is an autoimmune illness. And then just in the last 5 to 6 years, I've just basically kept my ear to the ground. There seems to be an epidemic of multiple sclerosis, a much higher rate of MS in Alberta, but I haven't looked at figures there. It's just high incidence. I did hear Andrew Nikiforik speak, and he mentioned that in Turner Valley, which is they have the oldest gas wells, I believe, in Canada, in Alberta, correct me on that, they have one of the highest rates of MS in Canada. So that made me sit up and think. I myself haven't looked at studies about autoimmune illness. I've got anecdotal data, but I haven't. So I'm just giving you that from Andrew Nikiforik. And I wondered if you could just repeat your question about the 5-kilometer.
Sorry, Vicki, can you repeat?
Okay, I guess I left the line. So what can we do to have a voice, those of us who are outside the 5-kilometer limit, to be heard?
Oh, thanks, Vicki. That's a great question. Thank you. The Council of Canadians, Lynn Gorman is the Prairie chapter organizer, and they've really taken this on. And David Swan, I just find him a very gutsy man. I know he spoke up a few years ago when he was on a health council, and he was basically fired for speaking up. But he's just been a great supporter to this community, and he's making connections all around. They're making connections. Different communities basically are coming together and really raising questions about the cost of Alberta's advantage, all of its energy. So I think you could connect, if anybody wanted to, they could connect with the Council of Canadians, with Lynn Gorman, or depending upon your political following, the New Democrats are involved with this, the Liberals are. I think even just going to your regular MLA, these people have tried to go to their MLA. They are at the bottom of our riding. The Redwater area falls within the Athabasca riding, and they cannot get a meeting with Mike Cardinal. So maybe you could help them get that meeting.
Al, you have a question from Jill. I'll read it out. Is there a unified voice? I think it's a lot of what Vicki was saying. Is there a unified voice within the communities affected by the industrial development, or are there distinct groups within each community holding different views on the development? If it is the latter, as part of the explanation for the divisive communities, is that some have no motivation to come on side against industry, that is, money talks? Are there any effective strategies to unite these communities if they are not initially a unified group?
Thanks, Jill and Bob. A lot of people are afraid to get involved. They're very worried about their health, but the spouse works in one of the factories. Though people did come together, even though they worked in industry, some families who lived right next to the phosphate factory came together and prepared an amazing presentation at an inquiry 2 years ago. Since then, so that was in, if you look at the North Saskatchewan River, if you look at the communities, you've got Fort Saskatchewan to the west, and you've got in just east of Fort Saskatchewan, you've got Strathcona County. So the people in Strathcona County in the northeast corner there, they organized, and they sort of they followed in the footsteps of some people who were just south of the Dow, near the Dow Chemical and Shell factories. 24 families were bought out and relocated, but they were the first really to be speaking up. So now they're gone. The problem is when people are bought out, they're muzzled. They have to sign basically a gag clause sometimes. So they may have done all kinds of homework. They know about all the emissions. They know about the shenanigans that have gone on, but they sign that they will accept a buyout. And not too many people get a buyout, but they will get a buyout as long as they basically muzzle themselves. They will never speak against the industry. They will never. So that sort of makes it difficult for people to organize. One group of 24 has now gone out in the Strathcona County area. Three people have been bought out, but they have been muzzled, and one of them was a community leader. So. Again, they've lost a lot of strength there. We needed to get that woman out. She, her father was ill, and but basically, when people get a buyout, then that hurts the community organizing. But since then, you've got some people left behind in Strathcona, and that group is growing because there's more industries coming in. And then across the river, you have Sturgeon County, which is in our riding, Athabasca riding, and so you have a group of citizens there who basically challenged the zoning of industrial land in 2001 for the Alberta Industrial Heartland. They lost. They were slapped with some expenses. But they now are coming together. They're working with people in Lamont. And And so that's just within the Alberta Industrial Heartland, people coming together. They do get discredited in the community. They do get digs because people are afraid for their jobs. And then they're connecting now with Lynn Gorman, who is with the Council of Canadians, and she and David Swan especially are working with groups throughout Alberta, basically people affected by the gas and oil and coal bed methane developments.
Thanks, Alice. We also have a question from Ed Madden on Illuminate, and there's actually two. First question, what percentage of air pollution in Alberta is attributed to the oil and gas industry? And the other question is maybe more of a comment, but Alberta is blamed for most air pollution, but how much of our oil and gas production is used by other provinces in the U.S.?
Okay. Lynn Gorman really is better at, she just made a presentation, there were hearings related to the gas and oil industry, so I have that, but that I don't have that information right at my fingertips. We export oil to the U.S., and under NAFTA, we basically are bound to give them a price equal to our own price, and yet the Maritimes, and I believe Quebec, have to import oil. So I'm not an expert on that. I can send you, I have the brief that was presented. You raise a good question, you know, basically Alberta is producing the gas and oil, and then the other provinces you're arguing are benefiting, but a big, huge party that's benefiting is the U.S. And so there's a Parkland Institute conference coming up that's focusing basically on fueling, you know, Fortress America. They just came out with a document, a research document on that. And so they're the ones that are addressing the questions that you're asking. I'm trying to get the Parkland Institute to, you know, here they are holding this conference and they're looking at Fort McMurray, but I'm trying to get them to look just outside of Edmonton because this is where the bitumen is processed. A lot of it is.
Cool.
Okay. Hi, Ella. It's Audrey. Just a question on the, what, if you have any reflections on the role of the media in this and the power of the media, because what struck me listening to you is I was thinking how much coverage there was when there was the derailment near Wabamun Lake, I think last year, and residents there expressing a lot of anger, and often because their summer's recreation was ruined by the spill into Wabamun Lake. And those people, those residents, or the people with the summer cabin, seem to have a lot of say and got a lot of media coverage. And I'm wondering, you know, how could, would it help to get the media involved in the heartland and in the protests of people who are really, you know, suffering far more than the Wabamun residents?
Thanks. I didn't catch your name, but thank you for your question. The media, it's just been a very difficult situation for these people. There was at the Agrium hearing on the very first morning when it started, when Agrium, the phosphate processing factory, was presenting its proposal. There were all kinds of media there, all kinds of videotapes being taken and reporters there. And then at noon, a decision was made by the hearing body that no media would be allowed in the rest of the hearing. They could take notes, but they could not film or they could not do audio tape. And I found that very unusual. And the citizens spoke up. I went to the hearing officer and I said, these people are not afraid of the media recording their story. They could not get media coverage when they presented. They could not have recorded media, any recordings there. In fact, one woman, one reporter from the CBC was hauled up to the podium. She had left the room, had left her tape recorder on, had not heard the announcement, I guess, and so she was hauled up and basically scolded. You have to realize, too, that Ralph Klein has a huge, huge media machine I think he has a bigger media machine than any other politician in Canada. And this is the conservative baby. This is, I mean, basically, this is the Alberta advantage. So these people struggle. They try to get media coverage, but industry has a very strong PR machine. They put out their press releases. There'll be a spill, and there'll maybe nothing in the paper. People will send letters. They won't appear in the paper. They're up against a big, huge media machine.
Al, this is Bob, and that was Audrey O'Brien who asked the last question. I recall about 10 years ago hearing that the incidence of asthma in the Sherwood Park area was significantly higher than the national averages. I recognize that the definition of asthma or lung disease is itself a sort of a point of discussion, but I recall about 2 or 3 years ago hearing that in fact that it wasn't really that much different than what you find in the averages. So what I'm thinking is it's still higher, but maybe is this a sort of an example of your popular epidemiology versus the sort of dominant approach?
Thanks, Bob. No, there is documentation that there is a higher rate of asthma in Fort Saskatchewan in that area. Again, I don't have the study here in front of me, but there is quite a concern. There's a lot of anecdotal commenting about it on the street if you're in Fort Saskatchewan, but there is documentation there's higher rates, and local doctors will tell you that.
Are there any other comments in Illuminate Land? And we have one more in ELC. Seeing no hands up, I'll let Ann Nonoff ask the next question.
Hi, it's Ann here. I live in Sherwood Park, so I have a vested interest in all this. I've lived there for 30 years, in fact, so I'm a prime candidate for any fallout here. And I've heard lots of stories, and I have anecdotal evidence, etc. I mean, it's the same old story. People's livelihood there is very much dependent on the wealth that's generated from the industries. One anecdote was to the fact that there was a much higher cancer rate in the county of Strathcona, which includes Sherwood Park. And that's a population of about 100,000 now, by the way, so it's not insignificant. And for a while it was being called the cancer county, you know, the county of cancer or something. Cancer of Strathcona is what it was called. And then that sort of blew over and people said, well, discounted that. That was just another anecdotal scare thing. So that hasn't arisen. I can certainly smell stuff from where I live in the middle of Sherwood Park, mostly in the evenings. And when I drive down the Baseline Road, Refinery Row as it's called, from Edmonton to Sherwood Park, I can see the flaring going on Friday nights. There is stuff happening, absolutely. And another point, this is all sort of fragmented anecdotal stuff, but Vic is raising, you know, the 5-mile limit. That's so ridiculous. I mean, pollution travels thousands of miles. Environmental pollution is found in the polar ice caps and in polar bears, which are being killed by it, that is generated from places like China. So, I mean, this whole notion that, well, you don't live within 5 miles and you have no business interfering is so ridiculous. I mean, isn't there some way this can be challenged because it just doesn't have any reality in people's lives at all?
Thanks, Ann. That's really what the citizens group that I mentioned and the Council of Canadians are going after. That's very important to them, that we challenge that not deemed directly affected, because there's a number of upgraders being proposed for the area. We're already at the limit. I mean, you have a good everyday knowledge of what it's like to live there, and anybody, I really suggest that everybody try to drive up Refinery Row, because I think it's a shocker when you actually see, especially when there's inversion. You drive up there when there's inversion, you see all the emissions, they're very easy to see those days, and you smell it, because it's just hanging in the air. Again, I could put on the website here, you know, the Council of Canadians as a contact, or the citizens group.
Hi, it's Chuck Taylor here. Do you have any examples of success stories from popular epidemiology, either in the province, or I suspect there may not be any in the province, but perhaps more broadly? Can you draw, if you have those examples, can you draw some lessons or some conclusions for what makes a successful campaign or fight back based on popular epidemiology?
Thanks, Jeff. The most successful story that I know of is the Love Canal story, and basically it was timing with politics. They basically, it was just before a national election. These were a lot of housewives who were organized, and they knew the politicians were coming to town. And for an hour or two, they basically, I believe, locked them in a shed, these two politicians. They somehow were able to hold them. Now, you couldn't do it in this time, you know, since 9/11, you couldn't do that. But basically, they played politics and a lot of direct action where people just, you know, use other strategies like Greenpeace to get the message out. I just find the stereotype of, and I shouldn't use this, but the stereotype of the redneck Albertan, you know, who's opinionated, I don't find that. When I'm working with these people, when I'm at hearings, these are very shy, intimidated people who are overwhelmed, who feel silenced here. So I guess if we go back to Love Canal, these were just, I mean, there's nothing stronger than a mother who's really worked up about her kid. And so at Love Canal, you know, they were worried about their kids, and they wanted to be moved out of there, and they didn't want the kids in the school. In Woburn, again, that's tied to the movie, you know, A Civil Action with John Travolta. But in the Woburn case, they went through a lengthy court process. And when I look at hearings, when I look at the AGRIM hearing, the people had dynamite data. They had a very good, strong case with experts from Cornell University, from University of Toronto, fluoride, world famous, you know, fluoride experts. So sometimes I question the official route. I think people have the right to participate in hearings. It's a long, drawn-out process. People get tired. They're juggling farming and raising their kids, and they have to run to meetings, and they have to get ready, and they don't know how to do science, and they're just overwhelmed. So it's a long process and expensive, and you hope you get funding. I sometimes think the most effective thing is direct action, and that's what got Love Canal moving.
Thanks, Nora. I don't see any more questions up there, so maybe we'll wrap things up. If anyone out there in Illuminate Land has a question, you better ask it quickly. I think I sort of feel like you've ended on a challenge to us. This last question: what can we do, and how can we start to have an impact on some of these hearings? So thank you very much, Ella, for provoking us today, and for taking the time out of your research leave to present your topic, and being the first person to do this via Illuminate at a distance, I should say, yeah, not being here in the room with us. So thank you very much, and thanks to everyone who participated today. Bye.
Thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. And I'll post the Council of Canadians website.